Bob Scully's World Show is brought to you by Walter Surface Technologies. Only the best. And by Clarks Technologies. Lighting the way to a brighter future.
Hi, this is Bob Scully, and welcome to another edition of the World Show, the Free Markets series. Quick, look sharp. Who wrote the Declaration of Independence? You know I'm not looking for James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. I'm looking for the author of the Declaration of Independence, T.S., one of the great libertarians of our time, and the editor of Reason Magazine. His name is Nick Gillespie. A lot of you know him. Here he is. Nick Gillespie, magazines are often like monarch butterflies. They're very beautiful, but they don't last long. On the other hand, Reason Magazine, by my reckoning, has been around for almost half a century, so I want to start by congratulating you on that.
Well, thanks for that. And Reason was actually founded in 1968 as a print magazine. In 1994, we started a website. In 2007, we started a video platform. So print is like radio was when TV came in. A lot of people predicted its demise, but in fact, there are more radio stations now than ever. We keep supplementing forms of media. We don't really get rid of them very often.
And there's something wonderful about the tone of the magazine. The way you write is certainly irreverent, but with a deep sense of history as well. And just to give people a taste of that, let me quote from the Declaration of Independence, T.S., that famous text that you authored. Quote, "At its root, libertarianism is about a default preference for the freedom to peaceably pursue happiness as we define it, without interference from government. It's the belief that the burden of proof should rest not on the individual who wants to sell lemonade, paint his or house purple, hop on an airplane, ingest intoxicants, or marry someone from the same sex, well, preferably not in that order, but on any government seeking to thwart or control such victimless activities." So that kind of sounds like the other Declaration of Independence. It's very lofty, but with some good principles in there.
Oftentimes unserious, profane, mentally disturbed. I've been called all of these things, and I plead guilty to them. The Declaration of Independence, as in political independence, I wrote with Matt Welch, my colleague at Reason, in 2011 and 2012. And, you know, in a way, what that testifies to is libertarians with a small L, people who believe in what Reason calls free minds and free markets, we often get a bad rap as being kind of out to lunch or abstract theorists and idealists living in dream worlds. But it's really the nitty-gritty of everyday life. And, you know, given that Reason started almost 50 years ago in 1968, when you look at the immense increases in personal freedom and in many ways technological freedom, educational freedom that we have now, the world has become more and more libertarian without fully recognizing it. There are tons of troubles in the world. We read every week about kids' lemonade stands being shut down by overzealous, you know, city bureaucrats. We see things like the revelation of mass surveillance programs by the government. The U.S. is still involved in wars that it shouldn't have been in the first place. But on a very basic level, people are increasingly free to live their lives as they want to. And that is a tremendous delivery on the promise of America. You know, going back to the original, to Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. We're not there yet, but it's actually important to keep looking at the ways, can you make your life the way you want to now more than you could 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago? I think the answer in general is yes. And one of the reasons, or one of the ways to make it even better, is by switching that default setting. You know, I use a lot of computer metaphors. When you get a new computer program, it comes with defaults, and it'll say, you know, it'll do this, but you can change it. we have, in many ways in our lives, let the default be the government gets the control. The government gets to tell you how to live your life. The government tells you what you can buy, what kind of light bulbs you can buy, what kind of meat you can buy, what kind of doctor you can go see. It's like we got to flip that default to let individuals who are increasingly smarter, wealthier, and healthier to make their own decisions.
And like most libertarians I've met, you are inherently an optimist, and a lot of things are going your way, but there's a paradox there because it almost seems as if, I mean, you point out that the things that are not becoming freer are the things that government really controls. And there seems to be a devil's bargain in there where citizens who are not really in agreement with all this liberalization will tolerate it, because government controls a few things that they really do care about, the military, healthcare, law and order, and all those things. They'll let you have your fun in some areas as long as the lid is pretty tight on the others.
Yeah, there's a great writer named Arthur E. Kirch, who was a historian who died a few years ago. He wrote a great book called The Decline of American Liberalism in the Mid-50s. It's one of the great neglected classics of libertarian kind of thinking. And he talked about how there's always, even going back to the colonial period in America, there's always been a tension between forces of centralization of power and of knowledge and influence and decentralization. He was a classical liberal, the forerunners of libertarians, and he believed that decentralized power, decentralized status, the ability to create things on your own was important, but it's always under attack and there's always a tension there. But this is the big thing. I've been writing at Reason for 20 plus years. The big difference when I started to where we are now is that in so many aspects of our lives, in our commercial lives, in our political, not our political lives, but our commercial lives, our personal lives, our economic lives, our work lives, we can dress how we want, we can marry who we want, we can more and more eat and smoke and drink what we want. Everywhere in our life, you go to Amazon.com and you can get tailored, individualized recommendations. Stores everywhere are giving people more individualized and personalized bargains. The only place where you don't see that are in the areas that the government controls, as you were talking about, and that includes healthcare, includes education, and includes retirement. And those are the three areas. Politics is a lagging indicator of where American society is going. American society has been going libertarian in a very positive way for decades now. And the future fight between, I think, libertarians and liberals and conservatives, because they're both interested in control, is how do we start whittling down things to bring individualized care and attention to things like healthcare, education, and retirement.
At the same time, it's not a universal progress. There are many areas of the world where, unfortunately, dictators are getting better and better at clamping down.
Yeah, no, and you know, it's not simply let's talk about it in two ways. When you look at a country or a continent even like Asia, 50 years ago, Asia was mostly not free. Even in China, starting in the late 70s and early 80s, actually started liberalizing its economy. And as Milton Friedman, the great libertarian Nobel Prize winning economist said, you know, you get economic freedom first, and then people start to get rich. And as people become more prosperous, then they start to demand political freedom, because it's, I've got money, you know, and you're telling me I can't buy this kind of car. I've got money, I can't do this, I can't do that. Screw you, buddy. And that's happening in China. There is growing unrest. We saw it in the Tiananmen Square rebellion in 1989. But Europe is more free than it was. There's some tension there. Places like Turkey, is going through a period of retrenchment where Erdogan is actually an autocrat. Putin in Russia is rolling back any of the freedoms that were gained in the post-Soviet era. But continents like Africa and South America, they are, for the most part, not perfectly, but they're moving towards more freedom. They have more economic freedom. They have more social freedom. They have more kind of liberty. And it's not perfect, and there are, you know, it's a jerk and stutter process. But in many parts of the world, overall, freedom is winning and freedom is getting better. There are places where it is not. And, you know, we could talk about the Middle East. We can talk about other parts of the world. But then the question for us, I think, in America and as libertarians is, what are we doing to help people who want to be free? And this is where another big part of libertarianism, which doesn't deal with domestic politics, but is rather about foreign policy, the one thing that we can say is that in the 21st century, America has had a absolutely disastrous foreign policy, and it is all built around, you know, first George Bush, then Obama, and we're waiting to see how it shakes out with Trump, but the early indicators are not good. It's about America going into countries and saying, you are going to live our way, and we are going to bomb you, and we're going to occupy you, and then we're going to bomb you some more and occupy you some more, and it is not working. I would much rather see, and I think this would be much more libertarian, for us to try and change things through diplomacy, through trade, through cultural exchange, and through welcoming into our country anybody who wants to live here, who wants to work for a living and make their lives better for themselves, their neighbors, and their children.
One striking thing in your book is that you hyphenate Bush Obama, meaning Bush 43, and your language becomes quite stark and radical. I'm going to quote again. Why would anyone with half a brain pledge undying loyalty to the party of John McCain or John Kerry, to name the two most recent losers in the presidential elections? Only a madman or a mental defective would take a punch for Nancy Pelosi or John Boehner, or choose to have their family members donate a kidney for Harry Reid or Mitch McConnell. The names are a bit dated, but I think we get the point. We exaggerate only slightly to drive home the obvious. Partisan politics, as it is, has existed for all these many decades, and it is your father's Oldsmobile, embarrassing, defunct, way too big, and no longer in production. I had a dual reaction because you picked McCain and Kerry, who strike me both as being pretty capable guys and pretty decent guys. So I don't know if you can paint with such a broad brush.
Well, no. And, you know, this is one of the other things about libertarianism, or at least as I define it. I actually define libertarian as an adjective. I like to use it as an adjective. I rarely say I am a libertarian. More typically, I'll say I have libertarian tendencies in this or that direction. And it's always about moving towards more freedom from less freedom. Freedom, it's not like the gravitational field around Earth where you kick free of it and then you never have to deal with it again. It's a constant movement, it's directional, it's a struggle. And with people like John McCain and John Kerry, they're good examples. On foreign policy, they were very similar. On spending issues, very similar. And they're variations of, maybe it's the difference between, plain vanilla and French vanilla or something like that. But it's differences of degree, not of kind. And what it comes down to for traditional or conventional politics and political parties, it's about control. I think libertarianism with a small L, and there are libertarian Democrats and libertarian Republicans, what they focus on is choice, individual autonomy. People should be free within the broadest possible parameters to make the decisions that affect their lives the most. And government should be there to help empower that and to kind of celebrate it, and maybe give a basic social safety net when people get knocked on their asses because of economic tumult or other types of problems. But the point is that we should be doing everything that we can to increase people's ability to make meaningful, informed choices about their life. And one of the places where you see this taking root in both among liberals and conservatives, I think, is something like the idea of school choice. Going back, charter schools, for instance, which are publicly funded schools that are freed of most of the kind of institutional and bureaucratic regulations and requirements of a conventional school where you go because you live in a particular neighborhood. Charter schools didn't exist 25 years ago. Now hundreds of thousands, millions of kids go to that or other forms of school choice. There are whole districts, school districts such as New Orleans, Louisiana, where every kid goes to a school they choose. And that's not that radical, because we're not saying don't publicly fund schools. But what we are saying is give the parents and the kids a wide choice. Give providers a wide choice to say, we're going to have a school that emphasizes math and science. We're going to have a school that emphasizes humanities. We're going to have a school that emphasizes trade. And we're going to win or lose based on how many students we attract and how many, how many people keep coming and how well we do in the marketplace. That's good. And that's a totally libertarian concept. And it's a totally libertarian public policy.
And I'm flashing back now to the Republican race. When there were 17 candidates up on stage, they couldn't even fit them all in, actually. And there was Rand Paul, all by his lonesome, sometimes at the end of the stage, and all by his lonesome. You couldn't imagine that he was really part of that race. He stood for other things. He was the libertarian. But when you see that and you hear a libertarian in that context, you realize they're lumped in with the conservative family, but they're neither right nor left, I would think.
Yeah, the fancy word that we use sometimes is to say that it's orthogonal to the political spectrum of right and left. It kind of intersects with it. A shorthand way of talking about libertarianism is that it's a philosophy that prizes social tolerance and fiscal responsibility, or some people might say it's socially liberal and fiscally conservative, although those terms become less and less meaningful because the Republican government, when George W. Bush ran it with a Republican Congress, they increased spending over time by about 50% in real terms. So the Republican Party is not the party, and conservatives are not the party of fiscal restraint. Liberals now, liberals are the ones who are behind speech codes. They want to shut down speech they don't like. They're the social justice warriors of the left. They're disturbed mm-hmm. by, they'll call anything hate speech. So they're not really socially tolerant. What we want to live in, I think, as libertarians, but also as Americans, we want to live in a world where you are free to go about your business and other people are free to go about your business. And you're not forcing people to live according to your principles. You can persuade them, you can show them by, not just building a better mousetrap and getting people to come to your business, but also if you build a better community, if you build a better life, if you build a better body, you lead by example and you lead by, kind of persuasion rather than force. That's really the nut of libertarian ideas.
And even though there was a libertarian ticket in 2016 that didn't do so well, all of this kind of leads to the conclusion that it's better that way, that you guys shouldn't belong to either of the two main parties. You should have a libertarian candidate until the day it works.
I'm not a member of the Libertarian Party. I know I've never been a Republican or a Democrat, and I don't think I ever actually joined the Libertarian Party. I like the Libertarian Party, but I'm not as interested in partisan politics as the pre-politics ideology, and that's where I think libertarianism, again, or being libertarian, is adjectival. It's a temperament. It's a direction. It's not five policies, and if you believe in these five policies, God damn it, you're a libertarian for good, and you should only vote LP. Rather, it's an attitude and a mindset and an appreciation for tolerance, for innovation, for experimentation. And that can inform your political commitments. You could be a libertarian Republican. I think people like Rand Paul is libertarian-ish. People like Justin Amash, a congressman from Michigan, Thomas Massie, a congressman from Kentucky, they're libertarian-ish, and that's good, and it informs the way they work in the Republican Party. Senator Jeff Flake, there are people like Ron Wyden, a senator from Oregon, who is very libertarian in many of his beliefs, especially about foreign policy and state surveillance and a few other things. Jared Polis of Colorado, a congressman, similar as well. So libertarian, I think, is a sentiment that comes before politics in the same way that other kinds of political or ideological commitments inform who you might join. I think what we do have in America, and this is the starting point of the book that you mentioned that I wrote with Matt Welch, The Declaration of Independence, was we had been looking at the percentages of people who identify as Republican or Democrat has been shrinking since the early 70s. And there's a reason for that. These are two ossified, stultified, crepuscular parties that don't speak. Whatever America, the coalitions that make them up were built to represent, no longer really exist. I mean, how is it that in the 21st century, in a world of, real pain and suffering and some economic problems, we get in a hot and bothered lather over transgender bathrooms. It's bizarre. Like we have a politics that was set up for 1950, 1960, 1970, maybe 1980. We're 50 years past that, and we have to start living in a world where, people are freer to do whatever they want because of technology, because of large increases in wealth, because of the breakdown of traditional gatekeeper institutions, such as the government, but also churches and corporations. They don't have the control that they used to, and we have to bring it back to individuals and the worlds that they want to build. And that's what libertarianism is about. And I think if you buy into that, you can be a Republican or a Democrat or a Libertarian. You could even be in the Green Party. And it's very optimistic, it's very innovative, and it's very forward-looking, which is one of the problems why the current political moment, really stretching back over most of this century, has been very difficult, because it's very nostalgic, it's very chaotic, and it's very backward-looking.
Mm-hmm. And thinking back historically now, going back to the beginning of the 20th century, in those days, total rejection also existed. And it meant being an anarchist, that was the term. And in Paris, Berlin, in Vienna, there were artistic movements that were rejectionist, but there were also political movements that were quite violent. And in a way, libertarianism sounds like an improvement on that. It's anarchism without the violence. Would you say that in a way you're descended from the anarchists?
I'll take it. I'm not an anarchist. I believe in government. I think it should be limited, and I think we should always be looking, especially we have a government now, as does virtually every country on the planet, especially in the developed world. We have a government that is $20 trillion in debt and shows absolutely no interest in actually kind of buying down that debt. We should be reducing the size, scope, and spending of government at every turn and in every way, whether we're talking about foreign policy, whether we're talking about old age entitlements, whether we're talking about funding for schools or for roads and infrastructure. There are very clear-cut, smart, market-oriented, freedom-expanding policies that can make that happen. A good example of that in transportation, not the sexiest issue in the world, but both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump campaigned on, making America's infrastructure great again. People are always talking about roads are breaking down, bridges are collapsing, we haven't redone the interstate highways. The easiest way to do that, there isn't a government at the federal level or at the state level that has the money to really, the way you relieve traffic congestion is by building more roads. No government has the money to do that, and we really can't keep taking on more and more debt because bills come due at some point. But there are ways, and this is something my colleagues at the Reason Foundation, a think tank that's affiliated with Reason Magazine, Reason TV, and Reason.com, there are private companies all over the globe that are dying. I mean, billions and billions of dollars in capital, where they'll take over roads, they'll expand and improve existing roads, they'll add some toll lanes for people who want to go really fast. They keep that money. But this way, we can totally radically improve and increase and enhance our infrastructure without it being a taxpayer expenditure. Instead, things get shifted to user fees, so the people who use the roads actually pay for the roads. And that's kind of an obvious thing to do, but it's also a very libertarian thing to do, and it's something that everybody will benefit from. We've already done this in various places where a private contractor comes in, they build a toll road on an existing road, they improve the other one, the toll road alleviates the congestion on the free road, plus they get the money, you can go even faster on the toll road. It's a total win-win. And we need to be starting to think like that with 21st century solutions, rather than constantly saying what we need is another interstate project. In California, Governor Jerry Brown, who in the early 70s, he became governor of California in the mid-70s, he followed Ronald Reagan, and it was such a generational shift. He was Governor Moonbeam, Reagan was 1,000 years old.
Yeah.
Reason loved Jerry Brown, many of the things he did in California in the 70s, because he was a penny pincher, he was progressive on drugs and a bunch of other issues. Right now, he's squandering his legacy in his second two terms as governor of California on a high-speed rail project, which will never do what it's done. I mean, he's got a fetish for a 19th century technology. We got to stop thinking about that. And with most people in power in government now, it's all 19th century projects. They're stuck in the past, and they need to start moving at least into the present, if not the future.
Well, Nick Gillespie, you, on the other hand, are clearly a man of the 21st century, and you've been quite eloquent. So long life to Reason Magazine and to you.
Thank you so much.
Nick Gillespie. And now here's something else coming up on The World Show.
We need to recognize that imports are the things that we get to consume without having to produce, without having to expend resources producing. Exports are the things that we produce and don't get to consume. So exports are a means to an end. And the end is imports. The end is consumption. And at the individual level, I think we understand that. But when we sum it up to the national level, when policymakers try to enlist the spirits of the populace behind some common national goal, it's very easy to be sort of jingoistic and nationalistic and to speak in terms of exports represent our might, imports represent our vice. It turns out that half of the value of U.S. imports are intermediate goods. They're the purchases of U.S. companies, U.S. manufacturers, raw materials. And so that certainly isn't vice. That's interdependence in the global economy. Our governments need to be cognizant and responsive to their citizens, but at the same time recognizing that these global situations do require accommodation of these migration flows. When people come here to work in the United States or come to Canada to work, by and large, it's excellent for the U.S. and the Canadian economies, respectively, to allow these people in. For starters, people who want to emigrate are self-starters. They tend to produce a disproportionate number of entrepreneurs, successful business owners. They are self-starters, and these are the kinds of people that we should certainly be embracing. And so our immigration, certainly the American immigration system, is broken, and we need desperately to fix that.
Nick Gillespie was our guest this week on the Free Markets series of The World Show. I'm Bob Scully. Have a great week. Thanks.
Bob Scully's World Show was brought to you by Walter Surface Technologies. Only the best. And by Clox Technologies. Lighting the way to a brighter future.